The best coaches in the game, we really ain't playing. We regroup up in the Slack chat where the coaches debrief. We be piecing these puzzles, occupy the chunk of the pie. Ain't no lie when we hit the block, helmets casket is top. You be seeing helmet after helmet, helmet after helmet. First place, second place, fifth place, eighth place, 12th place, 15, 16, 20. So many helmets, you got blurred vision, we got...
Welcome back, DFS Army. Another episode of the Bold Call Podcast. I am the host, at Alan Seslowski, here with a very interesting guest for you today, high stakes fantasy player. And you are going to learn a very interesting history in the foreclosure defense business. Mark Stopa, I am very happy to have you on.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And like I said, if you're listening to this podcast, Mark is coming over like a Zoom feed. So excuse the audio a little bit. We'll spice it up in the post-production, but bear with us because I think I'm excited to have Mark on for a couple reasons. One is I've been following him on Twitter for some time, and his association with running high-stakes leagues, being in high-stakes leagues. So I have a ton of fantasy questions for you, Mark. And then I want to get into your book. It's Is it people versus money, or is it money versus people? I always forget that in my own mind.
People v. Money.
People v. Money, which I just started reading his book. And as you're going to see today, it's just an insane ride that you've been on, isn't it, Mark?
It has been a crazy ride. Life has been pretty wild lately.
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to start light. We're going to go with some fantasy, and then I figured out a way. My whole week has been like, should I ask him about the fantasy stuff first, or should I ask him about his crazy personal story first? And I'm just curious from a fantasy perspective. So how I became aware of you, Mark, was Mark's ran a league that a lot of industry insiders are in called the Stopa League. And you put up just explain what the Stopa League was for the people and how it all came about.
Sure. I it's sort of an entrepreneurial league where I got into the fantasy industry working for RotoWire for many years. And I kind of parlayed that into, hey, let's have a league where I put up the prize money and everybody who's in the league advertises the league in the normal course of their fantasy discussions on the radio and the internet and that sort of thing. And so for me, it was like a marketing expense, but then I got to have fun by just playing with my friends in fantasy football. What's better than that? So it covered everything for me.
So basically, what Mark did was, I think he gave a grand prize of $10,000, right? That was the potential upside of the prize.
Right. I'd put in $10,000 and that would be the prize pool. And I would invite my friends to join for free, and they would feel like, well, I'm getting this free roll for a $10,000 prize. I'm going to advertise the league in the course and scope of what they would write and talk in podcasts like this and their fantasy advice columns, things like that. I've always been shocked that more people haven't tried to do that in order to promote their businesses and have fun at the same time.
Yeah, no, I got what you were doing right away. I thought it was awesome. Mark would have analysts from Yahoo, from RotoWire, from all over the place, from all different fantasy outlets. You had people from the Wall Street Journal in there, and they were just talking about this and competitive, and it was such an interesting format too. So that leads me to my first question from a fantasy perspective, Mark. What is your favorite form of fantasy to play? Is it season long, dynasty, and best ball? Like, how are you handling fantasy nowadays?
My favorite by far is auction, just yearly auction. I love the yearly auction concept. I don't like dynasty so much in football. I like starting again from scratch, and auction format's just the best. It gives you the opportunity to get any player that you want to. Drafts are fun, and you know, I don't want to sound like I'm nixing it, but auctions to me are just 10 times better. The opportunity to set up your team however you want. Nothing beats that.
And you know, that's funny. There's the auction only crowd. There's the snake only crowd. And then there's those who like both. And, you know, I like the idea of auction, but I'm scared that I'm always going to be, you know, and I feel like I'm becoming a better fantasy player having done it over the last 10 years, but I'm always nervous that I'm not going to know how to manage the budget. So, but it's one of those things, I'm assuming once you play it enough, you'll never go back the other way. Right.
Totally. Yes. Do it once or twice. And especially if you can do it in person, like with the Stopa League, we used to meet in Vegas every year, and we'll start that up again at some point. But you get 10 or 12 of your friends in the same room or same area doing an in-person auction. That's as fun as it gets.
Yeah. So what's your overall fantasy strategy? Like, what do you, you know, this is the year where people are attacking running backs, you know, early. And then do you have a build that you traditionally like to do in a, you know, a standard one quarterback, three receiver league? What's your overall overlying fantasy strategy?
I wouldn't say I have a strategy from year to year. I just kind of try to take the best players that I can. I'd push back a little on one QB leagues being standard. We need to fix that, make super flex leagues be more standard. You know, I like deeper formats. I will, if there's one thing I definitely push for all the time, I'd say have deeper starting lineups, start more players. That makes it more competitive, more fun. So I just try to take the best players I can every year.
Yeah, I'm out on one QB leagues. The only one QB league I play in now is the NFFC's, you know, the Beat Chrysalis League, which, you know, I'm not sure why the NFFC hasn't gone to Superflex yet. I know the guys that run the, you know, that business have, you know, they're more traditionalists, but Superflex is everywhere. It just makes the first round of drafts so much more interesting, don't you think?
Absolutely. And auctions too. Superflex auctions are so much more fun. I mean, and one of the ways I'd pitch that too is quarterbacks are by far the most important position in real life NFL. They should be more important in fantasy. I mean, why should Mahomes, who's clearly the best player in the NFL, be a third round pick in fantasy? If we really want fantasy to mirror real life NFL, Superflex does that. He's Mahomes, for example, clearly a first round pick in Superflex.
Yep. Cool. Yeah. All right. So I have some relevant, like I said, I'm here with Mark Stopa, who is a major Bills fan. He's a high stakes fantasy player, fantasy passion. If you're listening to this podcast, he's as crazy or crazier than you as far as his obsession with fantasy football. And that's why I love Mark Stopa from, you know, following him on Twitter. And we are going to get into Mark's book, which he wrote about his journey in defending in his I guess it's this adventure through the Florida foreclosure court system. Is that a good way to characterize it?
Yeah, that's a fair way to describe it. My adventure through the Florida court system and everything that went into that.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to get that in a minute, but that's what I'm saying. I have pages in front of me and I'm like, oh my God, all these questions I want to ask them all, but I'll start with the Bills because you're a Bills fan. When people draft in fantasy, there's always those guys that push up the players on the team they love. I don't do that as a Jets fan. I mean, for obvious reasons, but I don't. Are there players on the Bills that you're thinking about that you're pushing up a little bit or that the market's not seeing clearly on, starting, you know, with all of the new receivers to the guys they've had there last year? Talk about, I guess, first start with Josh Allen. You know, I have him very high. It's a top five QB. I've seen him ranked as low as out of the top 10 in some other. So where are you on Josh Allen for 2020 for fantasy?
Fancy, gotcha. First, I don't elevate Bills players for fantasy just because I like them. That's a surefire way to lose, especially when you're playing in expert leagues. But for Allen, I'd say I'm pretty much along with the consensus is for him in terms of fantasy. I mean, he's as good of a rushing quarterback inside the 10 as you're going to get. So those eight or so rushing touchdowns are a pretty good formula to have sustained fantasy success. And the addition of a wide receiver one like Diggs, That can only help. So I'd say he's 5-6 somewhere in there, quarterback overall for me, and I get him in some of my leagues. I'm not looking to get him, but he's somebody I'm certainly getting.
As a Bills fan, are you happy they gave up that number one first round pick for Diggs? I mean, Diggs is he about 26 years old? He'll be 27 in December, and you could have gotten, you know, a young 20-year-old like a Justin Jefferson type, or maybe a Jalen Reagor. I have to look where the pick actually went. But as a fan, are you happy that would you rather have Diggs or would you rather have the young unknown?
I'd rather have Diggs because you know that he's good. So why not get that, especially when they're set up pretty well right now for now in the next couple of years to win. Now I think they're the third best team in the AFC right now, and so I like how they're set up for this year and the next couple of years.
Talk about, see, when you come on the Bold Call podcast, you have to make bold calls, and calling the Bills the third best team, which I think is plausible, is definitely a bold call, but I like that for sure. So Diggs is going as the wide receiver 27 in redrafts. Do you think that is an underpriced just right, or is that a screaming value?
You know, I haven't gotten any, I haven't drafted any Diggs yet. So I'd say that's probably about right. And I'm maybe under market on him because, you know, Allen runs in a lot. They still have their the same weapons from last year. So Diggs, I like Diggs improving Josh Allen's value a lot more than I like Allen improving Diggs' value. So I'm not necessarily seeing Diggs as someone to target.
You know what? That's exactly true. I traded for Diggs because Diggs was a player that I was off in fantasy. I recently traded for him in a dynasty league where I gave up Cortland Sutton. I got back Diggs and I got some draft capital with it. So I was able to get Diggs plus for Sutton. And I don't know if that's going to work out, but I wanted something about this. Like, you know, once everyone starts hating a player, I start taking a look and say, everyone can't be right, you know, when it's something like that. There's some obvious ones. All right, moving on to the backfield. You know, I think it's funny. They drafted rookie Zach Moss, and everyone's basically crowned Devin Singletary as the starter. And in all of the other rookie situations where there's a veteran, it's been the opposite way, where everyone's like, oh, the rookie's definitely taking over. When you look about J.K. Dobbins, like the market thinks that he's going to win the job right away. When Damian Williams was still, you know, before he opted out, people were convinced he was going to have a role. But the one, you look at Vaughn in Tampa, but the one situation where the market has basically said, the Zach Moss is the backup. What do you believe is going to be the situation in Buffalo with the running backs?
I believe pretty strongly that the market is a little wrong here because I think that the market is treating Moss too well and Singletary too poorly. And to support that, I'd point to last season when Singletary was the rookie and 36-year-old Frank Gore was mudding his way to 3.6 yards per carry. Singletary didn't get his 21st carry on the season until week 8 or 9, something like that. So he was basically not playing for the first half of the year as a rookie, even though Gore was not doing well. So when I look at that's how the Bills front office treated it last year for the rookie, how are they going to treat the rookie Moss this year when Singletary is a lot better than what Gore was doing last year? I don't see Moss being a threat to Singletary's, you know, first and second down job and third down role, certainly in the first, say, half of the year. I can't see that happening, especially in a COVID offseason. I see Singletary being the guy and Moss just being a goal line and short yardage vulture, kind of like they were using Gore in the second half of last year. So I think Singletary is a round 4 running back is really good. And I think that the market is a little asleep on that. And I think that there's a lot of people who are drafting Moss in round 10 in annual leagues that are going to wind up cutting him in September when they realize he's not getting many carries except for some goal line vulture and short yardage stuff.
Yeah. So if you had, who do you think will have more rushing touchdowns? Actually, you know what? Total touchdowns, Moss or Singletary.
You know, that's close because I do think the carries from the one will probably go to Moss, but I think Singletary can get 6 touchdowns. He doesn't have a lot of touchdown upside given the goal line vulture potential, but I'd say Singletary on that in a close call. Now, I'm not a lot of conviction on that, but I think it's close.
Okay. So you're okay. So that's fair enough. And then Josh Allen, as far as non-passing touchdowns, you think he'll have more rushing touchdowns than both of them, not combined, but individually?
Probably more than either of them individually. Yeah, not total. I like Allen for 7 or 8 touchdowns, which is a lot. And it's scary to predict that for a quarterback sometimes based on history, because there have been years in the past where like Steve McNair had 8 rushing touchdowns one year and then the next year he had none. That sort of thing is scary. But Allen was, I thought this was crazy. Out of everyone in the NFL, when you grade the rushers inside the 10 from last year, including running backs, he was number 1 overall, PFF's number 1 rusher. Not among quarterbacks, among everyone in the NFL.
Yeah.
So that tells you how good he is inside the 10.
See, this is why I don't understand why anyone would have him. I mean, if you have him out of the top 8, I think it's lunacy, but you know, I mean, I could be wrong, but he's already proven, Josh Allen, that he could be a number 1 overall QB. I mean, he finishes the number 1 overall QB the last 6 weeks of his rookie season. Last year, he showed an extremely high floor with upside. That's what I'm saying. Like, I know, you know, whatever advanced stats or metrics you look at, he's not a real good quarterback by those stats. But when you're talking about fantasy, I mean, I just think that it's complete blind spot not to to be super high on him. And he goes, you know, so late in these drafts. All right. The player that I'm interested in, that it seems like, you know, in a world where tight end 8 through tight end 20 is a lot of the sameness, is why is Dawson Knox even being pushed out of that? Like, he's like tight end 25 or 27 in these drafts. Do you like, I liked him a lot. I thought he looked like he was like one of the top 10 tight ends in the league, or has that upside. Where are you on Dawson Knox from reality and in fantasy?
I like him in both. I like the upside. He had some problems with drops last year, inconsistency, but his athleticism kind of leaps off the screen when you watch him. And he's certainly somebody I like as like a tight end 2 with upside to be a tight end 1. I think part of the problem is there's a lot of mouths to feed in Buffalo now, and he's probably, you know, 4th in the pecking order. Right. So that limits his upside a bit. Plus, Tyler Kroft is still there, and I'm not entirely sure how much he'll eat into Knox's usage, but I like Knox to potentially be a, you know, a tight end 1, if not this year, then in the future. He has a lot of upside.
Right. So, you know, it's people also goof on when you say, hey, he's better in dynasty, just stash him. You know, I know that's like, this guy's better in best ball. Better, you know, so that doesn't really apply to redraft. So you think his redraft ranking is appropriate and you like him if you were in a long-term format, like a dynasty or keeper?
Yeah, I assess that by saying, you know, I've done a bunch of best ball leagues and I'm definitely overweight on Dawson Knox. So I think the market is a little bit soft on his potential upside. I don't think you can draft him as a tight end 1 thinking you're going to play him every week. But if your format is such that you need a second tight end, or you have one on the bench, then he definitely has tight end 1 upside.
All right, everybody. I'm here with Mark Stopa, who Bills fan, high stakes fantasy football player, and the author of People versus Money. And I've started reading your book. When I started reading it, Mark, I flew through the first 4 or 5 chapters, and then all of a sudden I'm a teacher, so I started working again, and I've slowed down a little bit. But every opportunity, my commute, I listen to a little bit. And the one thing I've come away with is that you are an idealist. You do not accept the way things are. You think you put all of your effort into the way they should be. And I think a good way to introduce you to the DFS Army podcast is for you to talk about and summarize, and, you know, in as few words, many words as you want. In chapter 3, you talk about something called moot court. And I want you to explain what moot court is. This happened to you when you were in college. What college did you go to?
I went to the University of Florida College of Law.
Okay. And tell this story. And I just think this is really defines who you are. And obviously you identify it as something that made you realize who you are.
I think that's fair to say. Yeah. And I love and appreciate the characterization of me as an idealist. And I think that that's a good way to encapsulate that. Moot court was an extracurricular activity in law school. It was viewed as something prestigious, where if you could get it on your resume, then you had a step ahead. You were a step above some other classmates. This was a competition that you had to try out for, and it was student run. And the students who were currently in the organization were grading you, and they were grading you as you gave an in-person presentation in a classroom setting. And as I gave my presentation, I could just kind of sense that something was off, something was amiss with the professionalism of the students. And so as I returned to that classroom later that day, I was looking around the room, on the floor, in the garbage can, and I encountered score sheets. And this was 20 years ago, and I still remember, will never forget, what was on one of the score sheets. And a little language warning, I'm quoting, "You suck, you take it up the ass, you're an orphan and son of a whore, your mom talked better when she was sucking me off, kill yourself and burn that cheap fucking tie." That was written verbatim on one of the score sheets that these students were drafting as they were judging the participants in this competition.
By the way, I'm definitely using that as the intro to the podcast. that clip right there. That's just unbelievable. But yeah, no, I interrupted your story. I made a joke, but this is a fascinating story. So go ahead. So you found these score sheets where people that are supposed to be judging you on merits and in this esteemed, prestigious extracurricular activity are making a mockery of it, and already that doesn't sit well with you.
Right. And it wasn't just that. It was racial, ethnic, homophobic, all sorts of discriminatory comments written by the students on dozens of score sheets. And once I found one or two of these, it was gross, but I went through the whole freaking trash can just to dig them all out. And mind you, there was a lot of work that went into this. This like dominated 2 or 3 months of your life in order to prepare to try out for this. Okay. And so I was angry, and it felt like a horrible injustice. So what I first did was I went to all the other students who tried out and showed them the score sheets. And I'm like, can you believe this? We got to do something. Nobody wanted to do anything. Well, you know, I don't want to do anything. And I'm just like, oh. And part of what motivated me was the briefs. There was two parts to the competition. The briefs were judged anonymously, and there I scored second among like 20 people. Mm-hmm. The oral argument portion, the portion where they could tell who we were because we did it in front of them, I was graded more middle of the pack. And so I was ranked fourth overall at the end of their scoring, and they chose to take the top three. And so it felt very much to me like, you know, hey, what's going on here?
Let me ask you a question. So do you think that if you would have finished in the top three, and I already know the answer to this, but do you think that you still would have pursued the injustice if you were accepted?
Yes. This is horrible. I mean, can you imagine spending 2 or 3 months of your life to prepare for something that's prestigious in a law school environment, and you get score sheets that say no Indians, we don't want them anymore. He's a fag. We don't want him. This was horrific. And so I spent my own money, and I made 75 copies of every score sheet with a two-page cover letter that I put under every professor at the school's door so that they had them the following day. And I wrote a 2-page letter about professionalism that I made like 1,000 copies of that I circulated to everybody on campus in order to show what happened, in an effort to say, you know, this stuff is crap and it's got to be fixed. I was the only one who did that. Nobody else wanted to do anything, but I wound up having meetings with the dean of the university and others. There were professors who gave impromptu lectures about professionalism and their next day's lecture, even when they had a class that had nothing to do with professionalism. So, you know, I wanted to be able to change how it worked when I encountered an obvious injustice. And that is a big, that was kind of an intro to what I did in People v. Money.
So why do you think that the others who this injustice was performed on, and again, I don't blame them, they were kids and they didn't want to pursue it, but why do you think they didn't want to rock the boat? Because I think this plays into the general psychology of how people think, self-included at times. Like, hey, I know what's right, but I don't want to fight it because there'll be some consequence. Like, what do you, and I know that's not even like in your DNA, like you don't even get it, but I think you're aware enough to understand why people may not want to do that.
Yeah, I think for that instance, it was a combination of some people said, well, I wouldn't have made the team anyway. And well, I don't want to step on any toes. Well, I'm friends with some of the people on the team. I don't want to get them in. I think people are just like scared. It wasn't easy to have to talk to the deans about this kind of stuff. But for me, I just kind of felt like I had to do it. And it was frustrating to me that more people didn't want to step up in order to try to fix it. And that drives me crazy, because that enables the bad conduct. When people don't stand up and say this is wrong, that enables the bad conduct to continue.
Okay, so that sets the stage. If you are listening to Mark Stopa and you see this is how he set his, how he became to, how you woke up in college, is that a good characterization of it? Like, you probably were always like this, but this was the moment.
It helped me. That was one instance that helped me see that corruption is widespread in many walks of life, and you've got to be willing to stand up to it.
Okay. So this sets the stage for what I want to talk to you about next. So Mark ended up being on the forefront of fighting for the people against the foreclosure industry. And I urge you to download his book. If you don't like reading like me, if you like listening to books, that's a great way to do it. Whoever narrated your book did an excellent job. If you prefer reading, it may seem like it's this big data dump of text, but I am telling you, this thing reads like a novel. And I mean, I would love to see your story made into a movie. I mean, that's how interested I am in the first, quarter of the book. But you talk about in chapter 4 specifically how you found, all the big companies always find these loopholes of how to screw you, right? So during the height of the foreclosure, let's call it, almost like a pandemic in a sense, where it was everywhere, an epidemic, you figured out by filing suit, you can keep people in their homes. I want you to talk about that, because anyone listening to this that comes into a foreclosure situation, I think this is a useful frame of thinking.
In Florida is a judicial foreclosure state where for a bank to take your house, even if you're behind in your mortgage, they had to file a lawsuit and win. So the initial part of my business concept to try to help people after the 2008 Great Recession who were facing foreclosure was just to defend cases and to raise whatever procedural issues could be raised and force the bank to come to court and prove their case and win.
Yeah, I mean, what made you even think of that? Was it something that you were like flipping through this big giant law book and you just came across? Like, to me, I was like, oh my God, like how did no one else figure that out before you?
No one figured it out before because it hadn't ever happened before. After the Great Recession 2008, Florida was just flooded with foreclosure filings, and I had homeowners approaching me asking for help, and I just kind of figured out that some of them had viable defenses, and a few cases turned into hundreds, turned into thousands. So I had thousands of cases at my peak. My payroll was over $100,000 a month. I mean, I built a machine in order to try to help people fight back against the corrupt financial institutions that did any and everything possible to try to take people's houses.
Yeah. And if you read the book and, a quick search of Mark Stope on the internet, you'll find that there's tons of venom spewed toward him for good reason, because any pioneer always has arrows in their back. I mean, Mark became, as you'll see, a target for against the whole system, as he calls out corruption with specific judges in this book and then goes through all the details and then lets you decide. That's what I love about the book. So something else to get people interested in the book, Mark, I thought that in chapter 5, you do the math where you talk about the bailout and how it equated to $25,000. Like, go through that math first and explain it to the people that haven't read the book yet.
Well, the $25 billion national mortgage settlement?
Yes.
About a decade ago now, the 49 attorney generals of 49 different states collaborated to say, oh, here's what we're going to do in order to try to help people fight back against the banks. We're going to sue them. And that culminated in the national mortgage settlement, $25 billion. And publicly, they paraded that around as, oh, look at how we fight against the banks to try to help homeowners. But of that $25 billion, almost none of it actually went to help homeowners. And I outline in the book and explain with links how more than half of it was the banks were permitted to apply to forgive debts that they didn't have to pay anyway. Because in some states, let me give an example. Let's say that by the time that you were facing foreclosure, your house was worth $700,000, but you owed $1 million. That was a very common ratio.
Right, underwater in
right. Yeah, you were underwater $300,000, say, okay? Right.
That's when people just started like leaving their house and just walking out, right?
Exactly. Lots of people were leaving. That was called a deficiency. There are many states that a deficiency is not allowed to be collected by operation of law. So if you got foreclosed, you gave back the house worth $700, the extra $300, the lender didn't have a way to collect from you. Okay. What these attorneys general did as part of the national mortgage settlement was they allowed the banks to forgive, which I'm putting in air quotes, that more than $12 billion of deficiencies in states that did not even allow deficiencies to be recovered. So it was just entirely worthless and meaningless, but they wanted to parade it around like, ooh, look at how we're at, look at how we're helping people. When in truth, nobody was trying to help people. All the big law firms or most of the lawyers who knew what they were doing wanted to represent banks because they had the money. And there was essentially nobody trying to help consumers. To help put that in perspective, I had 7,000 cases. I won over 2,000 of them. 2,000 times the bank's foreclosure case was dismissed. I don't know anyone else in Florida. There is no one else in Florida who even had 200 dismissals.
Right.
And that's part of why you were talking about me being targeted before. I was costing the banks hundreds of millions of dollars just through my practice and creating law and helping people. And nobody else was doing it. Nobody in our system of government was standing up to say, hey, what they're doing here is wrong.
And I don't want to make you talk about anything that you don't want to talk about. But so what do you think, like, you know, a quick Google search of your name and you start seeing the venom pour out against you. And, you know, had I not read your book and gotten at least the other side, I'd be like, oh, this guy. I mean, you know, we look at we're influenced heavily. So what is it that fuels your critics? I mean, is it just the obvious that, you know, you exposed corruption and they don't like it? Or like, what do you think it is that gives any credence or credit to your critics?
Well, here's what happened.
Is this a fair question, by the way? Are you cool answering?
Yeah, you're okay. Fine.
I'm interested. That's why I'm asking you.
Yeah, I won so many cases for consumers that it prompted banks to hire private investigators to manufacture a dossier against me. It was more than 100 pages that was circulated to judges and the bar in an effort to take me out because I won so much. This document was filled with lies and half-truths, essentially saying that I had defrauded a bunch of my clients, mm-hmm. which I hadn't. But there was so much in a normal universe, a document like this would have been thrown in the trash. It's kind of like the National Enquirer. But in my world, I was exposing, and judges were giving me inside information, exposing how the salaries of every judge in Florida statewide were tied to their creating a process that foreclosed faster for the benefit of banks. Mm-hmm. For 10 years, Florida judges didn't get any pay raises across the board, every judge in the state, until during that 10-year period, they did everything possible to eliminate defenses for consumers, changing the law, streamlining issues to make it easier for banks to win, culminating with Florida Supreme Court justices getting a $58,000 per year pay increase just a couple of years ago after they did that. I got a judge to come and testify for me in open court about how that's what was happening. And that's why some people within the system didn't like me, because in a lot of foreclosure cases, when they were uncontested, they could be pushed through really quickly. Well, when I'm there defending them, it becomes very hard for the banks to foreclose. It's a lot more work for the judge, and I'm standing in the way of their pay raises. Judges were individually graded based on how quickly they pushed foreclosures through the system. And so the bank's dossier manufactured by bank private investigators became the impetus for this governmental attack against me based on things that they knew weren't even true, which is why I was never even sued in civil court by any of these homeowners, because I didn't do anything wrong and they just made it up.
It's almost impossible to fight the government. I mean, because when one side has unlimited resources and firepower, and the other side is just, you know, is just a single person, I can only imagine, you know,
especially when they're trying to cover up their own bad acts, especially when they know that their bad acts are being exposed, and they'll do anything possible to preserve their own positions in power. And that's one of the things I talk about later on in the book, is I go through naming particular judges and pointing out their own financial disclosures and their own assets and their own conflicts of interest, how none of them ever get voted out of office because that's the system they've created, and they self-regulate. So if you want to file an ethics complaint against them, guess who it gets evaluated by? Other judges. So you get other judges who all never get voted out of office, who regulate themselves. It's this perfect breeding ground for corruption, and nobody stands up to do anything about it.
Yeah, I love the play by play, the line by line takedown of Judge Orfinger that you do in the book. I love that. I mean, again, like I said, read Mark's book. Okay. It reads like a novel, and it almost, like, in my mind, I was like, this cannot be true. Like, I was like, not that I don't believe you, what you're saying. Of course I do. But I'm just like, it's what you see in a movie. It's what you see in a movie. It's what you hear about in a movie. And you're like, I just can't believe this is the reality of it. And it's your experience. And it's a fascinating one to read. I'm enjoying the book. So I recommend anyone that's looking for, you've gone through your Netflix, you've gone through your Hulu, you have nothing else to watch. This is The People Versus Money by Mark Stopa. I'm loving it. You should definitely download it, buy it, and he exposes corruption in a very entertaining way. I'm sorry to giggle at your journey here, but it's fascinating. All right, so we talked about that. Hopefully, that got people interested in. I know it should in your book, and we could go on for hours and hours.
Yeah, but let me throw on the website. It's peoplevmoney.com. peoplevmoney.com. It was a number one international bestseller on Amazon. You can get it on Amazon. You can get the audio version on Audible. So I certainly appreciate you going through that.
Oh yeah. And we're not done yet. I have questions for you, but I'm going to lighten it up a little bit now. Right. Cause, that's heavy stuff. That's your life, man. You know? So I get it, it's your experience. And, I could just tell in your body language as you're telling the story, it kind of brings it back again. And I didn't mean, actually I did mean to poke you and get you going, and it makes great podcast radio, but I'm generally interested. Like, I feel connected to you based on how I'm reading about you. So, all right, here we go. I got a couple lighthearted questions in the last few minutes here, and then we'll tell everyone again where to get the book and how to follow you on Twitter. I think you're an awesome follow for fantasy football, and how to follow you on Facebook if they're more interested in your foreclosure journey stuff. All right. As a kid, you're a super fan of sports. What posters, it doesn't have to be sports posters, but what posters were hanging on your wall in your room as a kid?
Gosh, as a kid, my favorites were Ricky Henderson.
You have the Ricky Henderson in the Oakland A's?
On the Yankees, more so. Uh-huh. Charles Barkley, Greg Jeffries. Those were my three favorites. Greg Jeffries, that was right around the time that baseball card mania took over, and he was supposed to be this big thing. I had a billion of his cards. So those are my three favorites as a kid.
Those are the posters you had on your wall?
Yeah,
no, I embarrassingly had that Heather Thomas in the pink bikini one where she's got one foot in the hot tub. You know that one?
I do.
Yeah, everybody knows that one. That one was on the back. How my parents even allowed that is just sick. What's it called? So a question that I ask people, I always think it's funny, is what scary movie did you watch as a kid that still freaks you out today? You can't even watch it to freak you out.
I've always shied away from the movies that are the scariest. I can tolerate like the Scream kind of movies, but you get into the horror stuff and I stay away from that stuff.
Yeah. Like The Shining. I still can't watch it. I watched it as a kid.
Yeah, not my thing.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Cool. So yeah, those are just some fun things. So a couple more fantasy quick questions for you. Then we'll get you going. Mark Stopa. Are you, you doing a lot of best ball drafts this year?
I am. Yeah. I've always found the last several years, best ball is a great way to kind of prepare for the season, prepare for your most important leagues. Cause when you actually have got to hit the button to purchase someone, that tells you how you really value players a lot more so than just creating rankings lists.
Yeah. If I remember correctly from your time, in your tweets, you do 100 a year, right? Something like that. That's give or take.
I've done as many this year, but yeah, I've done as many as 100. I want to say I did 80 last year. They're cheap. You can do it for $5 or $10. So yeah. It doesn't have to be a big money thing. I personally like the 8 hours between picks because it lets me go to sleep and not have to worry about it. Different people have different views there, but I love best ball as a way to prepare for the season.
Yeah. We just brought in a new sponsor, Underdog Fantasy. They're going to be the sponsor of our regular podcast. And they're literally, have you played Underdog yet?
I have not. I'll have to try that.
Yeah. So the guy who created the Draft app, remember Draft that was around last year? So he sold the company to FanDuel, who dissolved it, and now he created a new app called Underdog, and it's literally identical to the Draft app. You play it on your phone; it's amazing. It's not as soft as the DraftKings. I don't know if you've done that yet. The DraftKings ADP is pretty soft. You can get some good values. This one's a little sharper, like the NFFC, but it's so easy to use, and they have $1, $3, $5, $10. So if you want to do a quick draft, they have 8-hour and 30-second options, so you could do both. So I recommend recommend Underdog Fantasy to anyone's listening. All right, Mark Stopa, tell everyone again where they can get your book. Tell them the best ways to do it.
PeopleVMoney.com has links to Amazon, as well as purchasing the paperback. And if you prefer audio, then it's there on Audible too.
And on Twitter, he is at Mark Stopa, MarkStopa, correct?
Yes, you got it. And that's where I am on Facebook too. My Facebook, I talk more about the foreclosure People v. Money concept. There's a People v. Money group page on Facebook too, mm-hmm. That more and more people are joining. I think that 2020 and everything that's happened with COVID and the government's response to it and lending out, basically handing trillions and trillions of dollars to corporate America and the rich elites and giving people $1,200 has opened some eyes to
yes.
just how bad our system of government is. And the People v. Money concept, which I wrote in 2019, is very, you know, it's that same theme.
Do you state publicly your political beliefs? So you have a lean one way or the other? Not that this is a political podcast. I'm just curious.
I very much rail against the existence of the two-party system. Mm-hmm. I believe that the fight, one of the reasons I titled it the book, is I believe the fight should not be Democrat versus Republican. It should be People v. Money, because I believe that both Democrats and Republicans are largely aligned with corporate America, because those politicians know that that's their best way to preserve their own positions in office and maintain power and get rich. And there are very few politicians on either side who are actually fighting for people. So I want us, and I believe we'll see in our lifetime, a new political party, one that actually tries to do what people want and serve the interests of people, as opposed to just the corporate monetary interests. So yeah. That'll happen at some point, just a matter of when.
Yeah, it's like, you know, up until, you know, even now, it's like people think a vote for a third party is a wasted vote. And, you know, I don't believe that. I believe that you vote for who you want, or you sit out, you participate, whatever you want to do is good. But yeah, I could talk to you for like an hour about this stuff. I think, Mark Stopa, I think you're a very interesting guy. I'm glad that I got to talk to you in person. I've been following you for a couple of years already. And I'm glad to, you know, to form this new Twitter friendship with you.
Well, I'm happy to do it too. I really appreciate you having me. You got a great setup here. You're obviously great on the air. So I hope that this does everything that you want it to do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we started this. So DFS Army, just to give you know, background, and I know those listening know this story already. They've been around since 2015. They have been slowly building. They have about 4,000 paid subscribers. And then our podcast here, and they get about, you know, 10 to 15,000 people listening to their podcast. And then I came along about 18 months ago trying to contribute some season-long fantasy football. And now that is evolved into also things I'm interested in, like what your book is about, and we're slowly building it. You know, we have a very loyal audience that comes back to listen to this podcast. So now that you are logged in there, we've been having more guests. As you saw, we had Chris Liss on, Dalton Del Don, we had Byron Lambert from Roster Watch. You are added to that esteemed Mount Rushmore of guests now, Mark Stopa.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't know that I agree about Liss and Dalton, but
that's awesome. Cool. All right, Mark Stopa, we will get back to you next time. All right, DFS Army, tune in. We're going to be doing a few extra podcasts this week with talking about best ball, Underdog Fantasy's ADP, how to sign up, the best strategies of that game. So tune in for that one later this week. All right, everybody, till next time. Goodbye.